welcome to Talk Nerdy. Today's Monday, February 11th, 2019, and I'm the host of the show, Kara Santa Maria. And I want to start out, as always, by thanking those of you who make Talk Nerdy possible. Remember, Talk Nerdy is and will always be 100% free to download, and that's mostly because of support from listeners just like you. I have a dual model on the show. I read ads in the middle, which help pay for the production and the time, because this is really a one-woman band. I do have an assistant, an incredible assistant named Noelle, and got to pay her as well. So that's super helpful. Also, I work with a team of editors over at Pro Podcast Solutions and got to pay those bills as well. So I read ads in the middle of the show, but I really do rely on support from listeners just like you through the Patreon model. If you're interested in pledging your support, you can visit patreon.com/talknerdy, just like Rob Schreck, Pedro M. Rosario Barbosa, Phil T-Bear, The Zombie Drummer, David J.E. Smith, Jeffrey Perez, Charles Payet, Jafe, Gabriel Felipe Jaramillo Gonzalez, Brian Holden, and Jeffrey Sewell have done. And if you want to show your support in other ways, you can rate and review on, I think it's called Apple Podcasts now. I keep saying iTunes, on Apple Podcasts, on Google Podcasts, anywhere else that you download your shows. And you can visit the Talk Nerdy store. It's talknerdymerch.com, and support the show by, you know, rocking some cool new Talk Nerdy merch. There are t-shirts, tank tops, hoodies, beanies, hats, all sorts of stuff, tote bags. You can buy the books that I've been involved in, and I can send you a signed copy that way. A lot of cool ways to support the show, both financially, but also by rocking some cool gear. So definitely check it out. Okay, enough about me. Let's talk about this week's show. I am honored to have the opportunity to talk to Dr. Ross McPhee. He's the curator of the Department of Mammalogy in the Division of Vertebrate Zoology at the American Museum of Natural History. And we chat about his newest book, End of the Megafauna, The Fate of the World's Hugest, Fiercest, and Strangest Animals. So without any further ado, here he is, Ross McPhee. Well, Ross, thank you so much for joining me today.
Great pleasure.
All right. I'm really looking forward to chatting. I know that on my end, of course, I was having some audio issues early in the week, and you were so kind to reschedule with me. You're quite a busy man. Are we recording directly from the museum today?
Yes, I'm in my office, which is a very good thing considering how cold outside it is.
That's very, very cool. So we are going to be talking about your new book, End of the Megafauna, The Fate of the World's Hugest, Fiercest, and Strangest Animals. So probably the most obvious first question before we get into any of the timeline issues is, what are megafauna? And don't we have some extant megafauna today?
Yes, we do. But let's begin with the definition. The word only means big animals. And how big is big? Well, in what we're going to be talking about, which is Pleistocene extinctions, or extinctions in the last 50,000 years, it's a convention to consider megafauna as any animals larger than 100 pounds. There's no magic in that. It's just nice round numbers and easy to compute.
Okay, so human beings would be megafauna by that definition.
Yes, and even some large dogs would be megafauna.
Oh,
but it runs up to, and I do mammals mostly, it runs up to mammals that were on the order of 4 to 8 tons that are now extinct. We're not talking about elephants in this case. We're talking about some of the giant ground sloths that used to live in South America. They were literally elephantine. And they're among the many, many species that have disappeared in the last 50,000 years.
And so, of course, throughout this book, part of the story that you tell is about the lives of those creatures, but of course also about their demise. Because I think that most people, when we think of great extinctions, and I think we've all heard, at least anybody listening to my show, has heard about this conversation about, you know, living in the sixth extinction currently. But really, we just think about the dinosaurs when we think about historical extinctions, even though we know there were more than one. It's so true. But this, we're talking, you said, last 50,000 years?
Yes. Let me explain that. Why 50,000? Mm-hmm. I know it's nice round numbers once again, but there is a reason. That is about the upper margin for radiocarbon dating. And radiocarbon dating is really important to this story, because if we didn't have a means of very finely dating these losses, we'd probably say, oh, well, I guess they all happened at more or less the same time. But that isn't the case. What is the case is that at different hotspots, at different times over the planet, you had these losses, and they generally affected larger species and very often took out, especially on islands, all of the larger species that at one time lived there. And it's this lack of synchronicity that is a fundamental part of these losses. And it just, you know, it's demanding some kind of explanation. Why would it be, if it was a bad thing to be big 50,000 years ago, why didn't that apply across the board, for example, and you get everybody of that size going down? That's not what it looks like.
And we're slowly but surely learning more and more about that because of kind of modern innovations in our ability to test these things.
Yes, we are. If I can, I'm just going to launch for a minute into some of the explanations for these losses. Traditionally, and by traditionally, I mean really now a long time ago, people thought that extinctions were environmentally caused. Climate change is the sort of phraseology that we use nowadays for what would otherwise be just natural losses. Mm-hmm. And there was a time in two centuries ago now, when people thought things like woolly mammoths and giant ground sloths and saber-tooths and what have you disappeared because of the ice, because we were in the last major ice age, which ended about 20,000 years ago. And that was, of course, a climatic change of a very dramatic sort, and it kind of made sense that that some species would collapse as a result of just not being able to survive that kind of thing. At the same time, people were beginning to realize that humans had been on the planet a long time and that humans had been interacting with some of the creatures that had died out. So by the end of the 18th century or the early 19th century, it was being wondered whether people had somehow been implicated. But once again, without a real means for dating, it was quite uncertain whether there was any correlation between people being in a particular place at a particular time and any of these losses. What we've subsequently learned, and this would be now the end of the 20th century and into this century, with huge databases available for at least some of these animals that disappeared, that there was a very strange correlation going on, and that's what I want to talk about now. What these losses seem to be most closely connected with is the first arrival of people in places where people hadn't been formerly resident. Now, what do I mean by that? Well, Homo sapiens, according to the physical anthropologists, originated in Africa. Ones that look exactly like us, in other words, anatomically modern humans, were already on the scene about 350,000 years ago. Thereafter, they got across into Eurasia, so that they were spreading through South Asia at a very early point by 200,000 years ago. They were going north. There's archaeological sites of 45,000 years old in places like northernmost Siberia. They got down into Indonesia, into Australia by about 65,000 years ago. New World is rife with disagreement among archaeologists as to when people first got here, but I'm just going to be conservative and say we were here somewhere around 16,000 years ago. So you can see right from what I've been talking about so far that there's a major disjunction between where and when we arose and when people got to the Western Hemisphere. Mm-hmm. And thanks to dating, at least within the 50,000 year period, it's now seemingly clear that when people first arrived in a new place, in what I call first biological contact, that was followed subsequently by major faunal losses. And this pattern has been repeated numerous times on the world's islands. The world's islands were, of course, the last places on Earth, the habitable ones, to be occupied by people. And these megafaunal extinctions extended right up to, say, about 800 years ago in islands like New Zealand, which used to support the moa fauna. Moa were very large birds, some of them being several hundred pounds in size, and they seem to have disappeared, again, according to the radiocarbon record, within the space of 50 to 100 years, which is very dramatic indeed.
So when we talk about, you know, modern humans, you mentioned potentially 350,000 years ago, sort of at the seat of humanity. But then you started to talk about these different diaspora, you know, going to Asia, going up north, entering into the New World. These timestamps that you were describing, sort of estimations based on the earliest evidence that we've found. But these diaspora, if you want to call them that, were occurring almost, you know, intermittently, but almost continuously from a certain period of time. Is that correct?
Yes. That's a very good point, Kara. What we have to rely on in terms of evidence is what we get. And there's no reason to believe that we, in all of these cases, have the absolutely earliest dates for the first people walking on shore on some island or continent. All we can do is estimate. I would say in the case of North America in particular, but this is also true of South America, there's a lot of people, a lot of archaeologists interested in the problem of the first peopling of the Americas, and very interested accordingly in pressing the evidence as much as you can to see when people first arrived. And although I won't say that I'm going to go to the wall over 16,000 years before present, it seems to be a fairly impermeable barrier at this point.
Mm-hmm.
Having said that, there are other kinds of indications, not necessarily well dated or dated at all, but what can I call them? Possible artifacts that, if they are artifacts, imply that people made them, and they are in contexts that seem to be very much earlier than 16,000. So it's hard to say. That's about all I can say on this. And another thing that is relevant here is that we shouldn't confine ourselves to looking at just one instance, like, say, North America. It's the pattern that is revealing.
Absolutely. So, you know, we have these different eras, these different time scales where people are spreading all over the planet, and it's occurring within the last several, let's say, 100,000 years. But as you mentioned, radiocarbon dating can give us some really fine granularity within the last 50,000 years. So we're not talking about dating, you know, dinosaurs. We're talking about dating, like you said, human artifacts, or animal remains, I should say, from a pretty, you know, from an, I guess, a geological perspective, a relatively recent timescale. How much resolution does radiocarbon dating really give us? Are we talking down to the year, down to hundreds of years? What do we know based on these isotopes?
Okay, well, first of all, what we're talking about is a probability function with any radiocarbon date. It's a measurement, and there's always errors involved in measurement. What's happened in the last, I don't know, 20 or 30 years is that we've gone from earlier chemical methods to using mass spectrometry as a tool, and that's permitted levels of precision that we never had before. So when you see a radiocarbon date nowadays, it'll be quoted as, say, 12,050 years ago, plus or minus 10.
Okay.
Now, what does that mean? It means that the error on either side of the main date there is only 10 years. So within within a probability function of something like 20 years, that is the likely date. That's where it's going to lie. Of course, because it is probability, you can have situations in which that is not true, and the actual date lies outside the as we call it, the one sigma error. But beside that, or apart from how precise we're getting, how accurate and precise we're getting, the real thing is that when you have multiply dated different species, where you have multiply dated localities where humans seem to have lived, if there is a pattern, it begins to reveal itself over time. And that's what I would say is true for certain places on the planet. It's not as though we have equivalent dating for some of the more, say, obscure animals that died out in these megafaunal extinctions, but we certainly do for woolly mammoths, for some of these ground sloths, for giant Irish deer, which that lived in Europe. And looking at that, and looking at the clustering, we can reasonably conclude that we've got a pattern, and the pattern seems to be correlated with human arrival. Now, I'm going to undo everything I just said, because we're going on a slippery slope to blaming humans for all of these losses. And here's some of the problems. If we allow that humans were the responsible agency for these losses, the automatic next question should be how? Mm-hmm. What were people doing? We're talking about people whose toolkits 50,000 years ago, or even 10,000 years ago, were nothing like what we have nowadays. Everything would have been made out of natural materials. Everything would have required preparation, lengthy preparation, in order to fulfill its function. You wouldn't go to a store and, you know, sort of buy what you need. That's just not the way it was. So in thinking about these losses, we also have to bear in mind that the human populations were nothing like what they are today. Mm-hmm. What we should be thinking of, say 16,000 years ago in North and South America, is that small groups were managing the journey from Asia, whether they went over a land bridge, whether they sailed in boats. These are open questions. But my point would be that there could not have been very many of them. Mm-hmm. Once they got ashore, of course, the big guys had never seen anything like upright featherless bipeds of our sort before, terribly awkward looking, stumbling around on two legs with no canines, no horns. I mean, what's to worry about, right? The argument that I need to mention now was Paul Martin's. He was very instrumental in developing this idea. His argument was that when you had biological first contact, the first contact between newly arrived people and the existing fauna, they didn't know much about each other. And the fauna would have been quite naive about the capacity of humans to kill them. Mm-hmm. And it would take a while for them to learn that. And in the meantime, of course, it was fat city for the humans. They could go about getting all the provender that they needed very easily. You just have to walk up to a mammoth, stick in a pointy stick, and there's lunch and dinner, probably all you need for the next month. Mm-hmm. And to follow that along, the idea is that with the capacity to have complete food security of this sort, people were able to expand their numbers, to increase their population very quickly. And it was sort of like a situation in which more people, more killing, more people, more killing, until eventually all of the megafauna were wiped out, save for the few that didn't live in the right places or managed to escape or what have you. What the radiocarbon record indicates, if we believe this, is that these losses were accomplished within a period of about 400 years.
Wow.
Now, that's not from 16,000. This is the earliest appearance of people. The 400 relates to a later interval, somewhere between 11 and 12,000 years ago. But here's what you have to feature. You have to feature that people were on the scene for quite a while, interacting, must have. They had to have hunted or got their food somehow. Yet there was an offset before these extinctions occurred. And what has happened in the last 10 years, 20 years in particular, is that the length of that offset is increasing and increasing, making it more and more unlikely that prey naivete could really be at the foundation of these losses. When Paul Martin was first writing, this is back in the 1960s, the record at that time allowed the inference that maybe people only got here 12,000 years ago, in which case you'd have the losses beginning almost as soon as the first footfall. It's looking less and less like that. So that raises, of course, a critical problem for the overkill argument, as it's called. Naivete is about all there is, because otherwise you have to imagine if it was sort of the typical situation nowadays where animals that are frequently hunted are very conscious of people and hide and don't hang around, that it would have been that much harder to bring populations down to the kind of minimum that would result in extinction. And if I could just point out one other thing, what you can look at ethnographically for the closest thing to Ice Age hunters, so to speak, would be extant groups of hunters and gatherers. There still are a few, very few. They don't cause extinctions. There is no case in the ethnographic record of hunting and gathering peoples ever causing the extinction of anything. And there's good reasons for that. One of the reasons is that without a very elaborate toolkit, like a machine gun, you're just not going to bring down animals in numbers. A second reason is they're probably fairly sensitive to the idea that you don't kill more than you need, which is what we have to picture for these Ice Age hunters in North America. They were killing at a scale that is unimaginable in order to bring down, in the case of North America, roughly 70 species in this 400-year period. Now, I must emphasize not all of those were megafauna, but probably close to three-quarters were. And how does this work? That not only are you hunting it on a scale that results in complete extinction, but you're doing the same thing to a dozen different species at the same time. Hmm. It gets harder and harder and harder to believe that humans all by themselves could have been responsible. So then we start looking at something like cofactors. Could it have been that it wasn't overhunting, or at least overhunting at this huge scale that the overkill hypothesis requires? But since climate change was going on at the same time, could there have been a fateful co-occurrence? And this is interesting because of our own experience with climate change right now. 12,900 years ago, something very weird happened, particularly in the Northern Hemisphere, but its effects had to have been worldwide, where the temperature plummeted by anywhere from 10 to 20 degrees Celsius, which is an enormous amount within a period of maybe as short as 50 to 100 years.
Wow.
Let me quickly say that this is based on inferences from cores taken out of the Greenland ice cap. So you're already dealing with very low temperatures, and it's how meaningful that level of drop would have been, say, down in temperate regions or tropical regions, what the carryover would have been, is really kind of hard to gauge. What you need is real empirical evidence from those places, and that's hard to get. But here's what we got. What we got is that there was this dramatic cooling. It's called the Younger Dryas, and it lasted for a little bit less than 1,000 years or thereabouts. And during that interval, we know from pollen records and other indicators that it was like the Ice Age started all over again. We were in a warming period after the conclusion of the last big Ice Age at about 20,000 years ago. The world was warming. The ice caps in North America were in full retreat. And then suddenly, at 12,900 years ago, something very dramatic happened and pushed us back into conditions that we hadn't experienced before about 20,000 years ago. So it's a weird occurrence. It's not the only occurrence in the record. These sorts of things have happened before, and they demand some kind of physical explanation. An explanation that I think is reasonable is that there had to have been something which caused an enormous release of fresh water into the North Atlantic. This is something, again, that we know from other kinds of records has happened on more than one occasion. How could that happen? Well, at this point, again, going back into the true ice age, into the last glacial maximum, ice covered effectively all of Canada with a few spots where it didn't, and the northern tier of states of the U.S. So this was a huge geographical feature. As it began to shrink, as the world was getting warmer, mm-hmm. get meltwater lakes pooling behind the retreating edge of the ice, and the ice acted as barricades. So you'd get these meltwater lakes that would just keep filling and filling as the ice was melting, until at some point, maybe the ice gave way, into, just like it does in a glass of water. When you put ice into the water, it floats on top. It's buoyant compared to the water. And if the water was achieving great pressure because of depth behind the ice barriers, then at some point it could catastrophically lift the ice, in which case it would flood out into the lowest spot that it could. Simple physical principle. And what that meant was flowing out, in the case of North America, into Hudson's Bay or down into what's now the St. Lawrence Seaway and straight out into the North Atlantic. The end of this story, the important part of this, is that if it was of sufficient magnitude, it could have shut down the conveyor belt, the thermohaline circulation that is responsible for taking relatively warm water from in the Gulf Stream, in our case, up into the North Atlantic and then bending over towards Britain and Europe, which is responsible nowadays for moderating their climate, even though they're very far north. They have temperate climates.
Oh, okay. So then what would have happened?
Well, this is the idea. If the thermohaline circulation was interrupted severely because of this freshwater pulse, which would have been on the surface, because freshwater is less dense than seawater, then the conveyance of warm water from the Gulf Stream would have been shut down for some period, however long it would take. And during that time, there would be nothing to stop temperatures dropping catastrophically. So is this plausible? Well, yeah. I mean, it's not implausible, given that we've got records for this kind of sudden temperature drop, that something very dramatic happened. Nothing was going on with the sun that we know of at this time, and that's been carefully checked out. It's not that we've got less solar energy. So it had to be something that interrupted the zonation, climatic zonation, that we think of characteristic of the world right now. We think of temperate regions as being temperate. Well, not really, not when you're coming out of an ice age. They would have been very cold indeed. So something had to be responsible for that. A freshwater pulse of great magnitude into the North Atlantic could have been implicated in this.
So you're saying 50 to 100 years would have been that range?
This is for the empirical temperature drop over the Greenland ice cap, yes.
And so, I mean, not that this was anthropogenic, because you just explained exactly how this could have happened, you know, regardless of the human diaspora at this time, that they've literally had nothing to do with these climate changes. But of course, as you mentioned, we are dealing with catastrophic climate change on a massive scale right now that is, you know, directly, human activity is directly implicated. And it's a similar time scale, isn't it? Like, this
yes.
is, you know, we're talking hundreds, maybe just 100, couple hundred years, and just dramatic die-offs. I mean, massive changes in biodiversity that we can directly measure right now. So it could be reasonable, of course, that something so quickly would cause animals to just not have the capability to adapt.
They would have been completely sucker punched, because the world was getting warmer. Things should have been great, and then suddenly you get a deep freeze. You mentioned at the outset the sixth extinction. Well, to the degree that is mediated by climate, and could well be, we're only talking about 1 to 5 degrees Celsius warming in the next century or so. It doesn't sound like a lot, but of course it is. It's an enormous amount. And when you think of the world dropping perhaps by as much as 10 degrees Celsius in the other direction at 12,900 years ago, you begin to appreciate how absolutely catastrophic this could have been for any living thing that would have been affected by it. I'm going to just continue the story to bookend this part of the argument. Mm-hmm. The argument would be, yes, people were here as they were elsewhere. Yes, they were implicated to some degree with these extinctions, but it was this 1-2 punch of having people arriving on the scene and hunting at unprecedented levels, perhaps, along with this very dramatic event at the Younger Dryas, which together could have caused losses. Here's a problem.
Okay.
As you can see, I'm a problem guy. There's an argument, and then I think it through, and then I say, well, what about this?
And
what
about that?
Yeah. Right. So here's the problem with the climate change argument. It's not that it wouldn't have had a profound effect on the Northern Hemisphere, clearly would have, particularly in the North Atlantic. And you can expect some degree of attenuation as you go out into the tropics and down into South America or elsewhere on the planet. But one of the confounding things, and I think it is a truly confounding thing, is once again radiocarbon evidence indicates that there was a similarly large megafaunal extinction in South America, maybe offset by a few hundred years from the one that occurred in North America, but otherwise coeval, same time. And if it was also due to the same effect of drastic temperature collapse, then you'd expect the rest of the world to show kind of the same thing, that this would have been a worldwide phenomenon. But it really wasn't. This was Western Hemisphere, and it was only the continents. In the West Indies, which used to have not a substantial mammal fauna, but much larger than it is today, nobody died out. Nobody died out until about 6,000 years ago. And guess what? That's when the first archaeological evidence for people comes in.
So we're circling back now.
Yes. It's a morass. There's no way, if you are into this, that you can insist that there's only a single explanation that makes sense of all of the data. Mm-hmm. But there is a new player. And this is another thing that I think is just totally fascinating. So everybody is aware, I'm sure anybody who listens to your program is going to be interested in science, knows that at 66 million years ago, there was an impactor in the Yucatan. It's the Chicxulub impactor, as it's known. And this is the leading argument for how dinosaurs and about 75% of everything else living at the time disappeared. All of the knock-on factors as a result of impact.
Mm-hmm.
And what we might wonder with regard to the Younger Dryas is, well, what was the precipitating influence that could have released this much freshwater? I gave you the simple physical example of the water going under the ice, uplifting it, and you get a catastrophic drainage. But what if there was something that actually forced that at a point when these lakes were absolutely massive? The one I have in mind right now is called Glacial Lake Agassiz. And if you just get out your virtual map in your mind and think of everywhere from, say, the Dakotas through Manitoba and Canada up into the Northwest Territories and then spreading out over the Canadian prairies, all of that was underwater. In terms of volume, it was equivalent, so they say, to the Great Lakes. So this is a tremendous amount of water just building up over centuries. The argument has recently been made that maybe it was, again, an impactor that was the triggering event. And what we have in this case, at least in the form of the original argument, was that a comet or asteroid coming in over the ice cap over North America exploded, as these things frequently do, releasing a lot of smaller asteroids, and that with the infrared heat pulse involved as the rock was going through the atmosphere, and of substantial size, we're not talking in this case about a small meteorite, that it would have melted the ice in such a way that you'd get this flood event. People poo-pooed this. This argument was made a little over 10 years ago. And they said, oh, how ridiculous. You know, you've got a dinosaur obsession, so you want to explain Pleistocene extinctions in exactly the same sort of way. But very doggedly, there's very good people involved in this. Very doggedly, they went to all kinds of localities in North and Northern South America, over in Europe, and actually picked up evidence more or less right on spot. 12,900 years ago, for things like rare earth anomalies. It's the same kind of thing, the iridium anomaly that the Alvarezes used as a predictor for the Chicxulub impactor years before there was a known crater
So that is that kind of what we think of as the KT boundary?
That's the KT boundary.
Okay.
Right.
Yeah. All those different molecules in that line of the rock that shouldn't have been there unless there was an impact.
Right. And the thing about iridium is that it has a very, very low abundance on Earth. So if mm-hmm. you find a layer, you find a stratum in which it's jacked up, that is practically the fingerprint of some sort of extraterrestrial visitor having hit the planet. So the people involved in the younger Dryas, or the Clovis impactor, as it's sometimes called now, made the argument on the basis of evidence that they were finding for things like nanodiamonds and shock quartz and platinum group metals. All of these are very consistent with the arrival of a fairly large extraterrestrial object. And they said, well, this is it. The signature is there.
Okay. But no crater?
But no crater until about, I don't know, a month and a half ago. When the Danish, well, as usual, the story is going to get very complicated, Kara.
Wow, so hold on to your chair. Like after you wrote your book, huh?
Yes.
Oh, no.
Yes, but here's the deal. The Danish Natural History Museum has been working in Greenland for many years, and one of the things they do is surveys, and nowadays using means of sensing landforms under the ice. And what they found way, way up in the northwestern quadrant of Greenland was a circular feature. You don't get circular features that often unless it's associated with something like an impact crater. They have not managed to get into sediments inside the crater, so it does not have a date yet.
Okay.
But in their press releases, they said, you know, this could be the Clovis impactor. It could be at 12,900, or it could be as old as 3 million years. So you see the problem, right?
Yeah.
Now, in some ways, it's not a bad fit, because the prediction earlier was that whatever this bolide was, that it hit somewhere over the northern hemisphere. Mm-hmm. What they argued, what the people originally argued, was that the rocks just hit the ice, so that's the reason why there's no crater, right? The ice absorbed the impact. But now we might have something quite different. We might have the actual place where the impact occurred with all the knock-on effects. This would be, mm-hmm. just as I said, with the big infrared pulse, any number of other things that it could have caused, as a way of influencing whether or not the ice cap would break up in such a way that you got this meltwater pulse and all the rest follows. Or not.
All right, everyone, I want to take a quick break from the show to thank the sponsors of this week's episode, starting with Twillery. Now, you heard me talk about Twillery last week, and that's because I think their shirts are great. I got a bunch of them for all the different guys in my life, and it was awesome because they have a bunch of different styles. I was able to get like preppy ones, more casual ones, really classic tailored, crisp white ones, and even for, you know, someone very special in my life, this fabulous white shirt with like little skulls in the collar. Super, super cute. They're ultra tailored. I mean, this person that I got them for usually wears custom tailored shirts, and this fit as well, if not better, than some of the shirts that he's had tailor made for him. And they have these wonderful touches like free brush nickel collar stays that are included with each shirt, and they keep your collars looking sharp. They're really cool. They're slimming. You can wear them tucked, untucked. They're non-iron, and they aren't, you know, expensive, guys. These are like actually affordable, semi-custom, beautiful shirts. And when you buy more, you save more. So you can get a $100 shirt for only $55 when you buy in bulk. And come on, you're going to need more than one shirt anyway. So I don't know what you're waiting for. As a listener of my show, you can get $25 off your first shirt by going to twillery.com/nerdy and entering the promo code nerdy at checkout. So remember, that's $25 off your first order. You've just got to go to Twillery, twillory.com/nerdy, and enter the promo code nerdy at checkout. I also want to thank a brand new sponsor for their support of Talk Nerdy, Curiosity Stream. It's the world's first streaming service addressing our lifelong quest to learn, explore, and understand. And it was founded by John Hendricks, who also founded the Discovery Channel way back when. You can access it across a bunch of platforms. There's a web app. You can get it on Roku, Android, Xbox One, your smart TVs, iOS, your Chromecast, Amazon Fire, Amazon Kindle, and hey, Apple TV, in case that wasn't enough. And the content spans science, nature, history, technology, society, and lifestyle, all the things that we love. I know we love them. Do you guys remember last week when I had Sonia Pemberton on the show and we talked about her newest documentary, Vitamania, featuring Veritasium's Derek Muller? Well, guess where you can watch it right now? On Curiosity Stream. And guys, you get a special offer just for listening to Talk Nerdy. It's unlimited access to the world's top documentaries and nonfiction series by entering the promo code NERDY at curiositystream.com/nerdy. You're going to get a free membership during the first 30 days. You'll get access to stream over 2,000 documentaries and nonfiction titles from some of the world's best filmmakers. And there's also exclusive originals right there. So guys, starting at just $2.99 a month, and 30 days for free, you've just got to go to curiositystream.com/nerdy and use the promo code NERDY during the sign-up process. All right, everybody, let's get back to the show. Is your hypothesis then that you lay out in the book that it is really a combination of different factors?
Well, let's look at it this way. Everybody wants an explanation for a phenomena, whatever they are. And in some cases, you can just appeal to very simple physical principles, and everyone says, oh, yeah, that makes sense. With something like extinction, particularly extinction in suspicious circumstances because of the presence of humans in all of this, it's not so easy because people who are predisposed to believe that humans do hideous things in all environments in which they exist are going to say, well, come on. You know, you told us about this biological first contact thing, pattern repeats, blah, blah, blah. Of course, people were responsible. It may have been indirect. One of the arguments I made years ago is that perhaps it wasn't actually overhunting. It could have been the importation of particularly dangerous pathogens along with humans that brought them in. The humans were not affected because perhaps they'd grown up with the pathogens, but they were lethal for the large animals that they affected. Apart from that, apart from these sort of collateral effects or indirect effects, a lot of my colleagues would say, you should conclude that it's more or less open and shut because we know what people are all about. If they weren't directly responsible, then they were indirectly by other things that they did, perhaps unknown levels of environmental damage that we don't have a clear record of. And so it goes. On the other side, where people are more disposed to look to natural consequences of dramatic events, like the ones I described for the Younger Dryas, we'll say that you have to bear this in mind, or that this actually might have been conclusively the real problem. And if you go through all of the arguments that are available, then you end up with this huge smorgasbord, none of which you can give a quantity too, in terms of the net effect. We don't have a time machine, so therefore we can't rate what any of these individual arguments mean for the whole occurrence. And although I'm not in favor fundamentally, scientifically, of using multiple explanations where one should do, in this particular case, I don't have an alternative because I don't see that any of the arguments are sufficiently conclusive to line up behind. And one of the things that I wanted to kind of bring forth in the book is that nor should anybody think that it's a simple matter to look in an archaeological or a paleontological record and be crystal clear on what happened to the animals or the humans or anything else that was involved therein. You need as much evidence as you can get on point, and you should always be looking for other kinds of evidence that test your arguments.
I mean, it really reinforces to me yet again this kind of dinosaur bias that a lot of us have, that we think about the extinction event in the dinosaurs in this very clean cut way. When even that, you know, all the time we're reading new articles about, oh, they were in decline and, you know, many of these species had already been lost by the time the impact hit. And, you know, it wasn't as clear cut as that. And as you mentioned, across the globe in different island areas, different pockets, these extinction level events, if we want to call them that, occurred at slightly different times.
Yes.
That's important.
That is the pattern. And one possible conclusion, although it's not helpful, one possible conclusion is we really don't have the trigger mechanism. We've got all of these things that we think might be important, but none of them add up. Mm-hmm. So we're missing something big. Which is true of the dinosaur extinctions, if you think that those were all due to the impact. Or until the Alvarezes came along, it was early mammals eating dinosaur eggs and things like this. Highly, highly improbable. Mm-hmm. But since there wasn't anything else, these arguments got repeated. So this is why, although it's in some ways a very tired argument as to the cause of these near-time extinctions, it continues to be intellectually interesting because I don't think even now we have a proper handle on it. And the significance of that in the larger realm is, so how do we know what the sixth extinction is going to be all about? Yes, it's in the news. It's been widely reported. It's going to be as bad as the end Permian extinction. Well, really? How do you know that? Yeah. What's the basis for the argument?
It's the first time, I suppose, that we've been able to see it happening before our eyes. And I guess that's a pretty scary prospect for individuals who only think of these things as being ancient. But even as you mentioned, 50,000 years ago is not ancient, at least not in an evolutionary timescale or really a geological timescale. This is quite recent. And would this, the end of the megafauna, would this have been the fifth extinction?
No, not really. You know, if you look at these graphs that have been produced over the years for the Big Five and similar sorts of things, this doesn't rate at all.
Gotcha.
It was largely confined to mammals and birds, a lot of birds that went down at the same time, and large birds for the most part, like raptors. Mm-hmm. It kind of trailed off thereafter, or at least we don't have really good evidence for how it hit reptiles and amphibians. And in fact, amphibians, we don't know anything about as to whether or not there were extinctions correlated with near time. We do know that there were certain groups of reptiles and their relatives that were affected. For example, large tortoises in many places, particularly islands once more, went down very quickly. Crocodiles in some places, things of that nature. But it was basically a big hit on mammals. And one thing we haven't talked about, Kara, is, well, so what? Why were the big guys affected so badly? Why wasn't it sort of spread out, as is usually the case in larger extinctions, where body size is not that relevant? Everybody gets a hit. Well, the closest that I think anybody has come to this, interpreting the detail of why it was the big guys were the least likely to survive, has everything to do with their life history. What I mean by life history are characteristics that tend to be correlated with particular ecosystem roles or body sizes or things of that nature. We're talking about body size in this case. Larger mammals have a constellation of life history features, which is pretty general. One is that they live a long time, which is generally true of large vertebrates in general. Think of tortoises lasting for a century. But what it is correlated with is relatively long pregnancies. Now we're just talking about mammals.
Okay.
So for example, if you think of elephants coming in at say 4,000 kilograms, they usually only have singleton births. Twins are extremely rare, more than that, never seen. And pregnancies last from 20 to 22 months for living African and Asian elephants. And we can think of humans, 9 months, that's still a long time. Singleton births are the rule.
And they also have to wean those animals for quite a while.
Yes, they do. And here the concept would be that whatever takes species out has to hit certain parts of the demographic profile very, very hard so that recovery becomes less and less likely. Mm-hmm. So if it was the case for any reason that it was the younger members of a species, those that were in their fertile years, something of that nature, or very young animals dependent on their mothers and not able to take care of themselves, which would certainly be true for a woolly mammoth, that if they were hit so hard that you did not have many fertile individuals, let's put it that way, sure, surviving through the crisis, then it would take a comparatively long time to recover. And if the hits kept on coming, then again, this is all a plausibility argument, over time, there would be fewer and fewer opportunities for isolated animals to meet one another for the purpose of procreation. There would be destruction of herd structure. You can come up with all kinds of reasons for why it would have imperiled the life histories of large animals. And I think that makes a lot of sense, that yeah, there had to be something drastic that happened, but it had to have hit in a way that ensured that generational replacement was affected principally. And you do that by cutting off the means of production, sure, reproduction.
Is there something to be said about the fact that the larger the animal, whether it's an herbivore or a carnivore, an omnivore, really, that because they're so large, they had fewer, if any at all, natural predators?
Well, that's certainly true now, if we're thinking, say, in the case of Africa, with elephants. Elephants don't have predators, except for us.
Or rhinoceros, or, yeah, exactly, any of these really large, yeah, organisms.
Right. In the Pleistocene, it could have been different, to the degree that there were, now thinking of North America or South America for that matter, there were a lot more predators, different species. There were several kinds of big cats instead of just pumas, which is jaguars down in the southwestern part of this country.
Sure.
We had a couple of different kinds of saber-toothed cats, very large animals. We had gigantic bears. Whether they were actually pursuit carnivores or scavengers is open to question, but you know, who knows? Once again, our inferences about past behavior have to be founded on very imperfect evidence. One of the things that I should have mentioned in my discussion of overkill, another thing that is so hard to conjure with, is the African context. Whereas all of these extinctions that I described seem to follow hard on the first appearance of people, nothing, comparatively speaking, happened in Africa. Africa did not have...
Where people originated.
Right. It did not have an episode of marked loss within the 50,000-year interval.
Yeah, of that's course, just Paul, happening now.
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct. Paul Martin, of course, was ready with an answer, and I'm going to give it to you, and you can think it over and think with whether you agree with it, you and your listeners. He said that what you're looking at in the case of hominin evolution and their prey species in Africa was that it was kind of an arms race, that as people got better technology, hunted better in terms of bringing down animals, the animals got smarter. They figured out early on that, you know, a human with a hand axe was maybe not all that dangerous, but somebody who could launch a spear with a point on it could be very dangerous indeed. And over time, consequently, they stayed very clear that humans were dangerous. And for that reason, they've managed to persist. Whereas in these other cases, what you had ostensibly was people coming with already advanced stone technology, as one example, so that the animals didn't stand a chance.
I see. So it's kind of the difference between sort of coexisting and in some ways co-evolving versus just showing up out of the blue
exactly
quickly with this technology. And of course, we talk about, you know, you were talking about the naive animals versus maybe in some ways the animals that have gotten wind or that have gotten more clever. But of course, this doesn't even have to be a conscious effort. I mean, we're seeing this fascinating scenario right now where I can't remember if it's rhinoceros, I think it's just elephants, are literally being born without tusks and they stand a better chance against the background of poaching. this is like short term in many ways effects of natural selection that's happening before our eyes, that these tuskless creatures are faring better simply because their greatest predator is the human being.
Yeah, that's actually been documented for the Asian elephant. There used to be, 200-300 years ago, huge tuskers, which is why people like to go out and elephant hunt so that they could get, you know, the best in terms of tusk size. The genes for those very big bulls have been progressively lost, and now it is the case that Asian elephants have very small tusks indeed. In fact, females often don't even have protuberant tusks. You can't see them under the lip. It's also been suggested for elephants that if you could using modern genetic engineering techniques like CRISPR, edit out the parts of the genome that cause the incisors, which are the tusks, to grow to the lengths that they do, so that you could have future elephants that, in fact, don't have the genetic mechanism anymore to grow big tusks.
And then would be secure, yeah.
Yeah, so taking care of the poaching problem, but leaving them defenseless and without the apparatus that they evolved with to meet their environmental needs with.
Sort of the lesser of two evils there.
Well, right, but the fundamental evil, of course, is why it happened in the first place, which has everything to do with us.
Yeah, and that's really that. I mean, I guess this really is a shift in the conversation, but it really is this ethical conundrum of how much, and that's really what we've been talking about this whole time, how much did we as a species have to do with these declines or these losses, and how much can we as a species contribute to preventing further catastrophe? And that's in many ways why we have zoos. It's not why zoos first started, but it's why modern zoos persist for conservation, right? It's why we have conversations about de-extinction and whether or not that's an ethical boon or that would be a devastating thing to attempt. And it's complicated. Can we undo the damage that, regardless of whether this was environmental, that we know that human beings at least had some amount of activity to contribute to these losses? Can we undo them or at least mitigate them? And should we?
There is no question that humans are the most dangerous species on the planet and have long been. The only saving grace we have is that we have our consciousness and our mental capacities that we should bring to bear on these problems. And of course, it's changed a lot even in my lifetime in respect of what people care about. 50 years ago, you could say that whatever goes on in Africa with regard to poaching at the time really doesn't make very much difference because there's always another elephant, there's always another rhino. And people have progressively learned, thanks to media, thanks to exposés of one sort and another, that there isn't always another elephant or another rhino. Mm-hmm. And that if you want those animals to be part of our children's inheritances in terms of the natural world, then you've got to do something about it, which is why we have legislation in this country now that prevents the import of ivory, of modern elephant ivory. You can still get woolly mammoth ivory, but for the living species, it's no longer legal, and that's that, and the trafficking in exotic species. There's very strong international regulation of that nowadays. And one hopes that it actually makes a difference. It seems very depressing when you look at the numbers. For example, the loss of the last northern white rhino, which occurred in early 2018, that is a subspecies that was literally hunted to death. No two ways about it. Just for the horns, just for making dagger handles in Yemen and for aphrodisiacs in the Far East. There was no economic reason why that had to happen, but it did. And what can we do about it? Well, almost literally nothing, except for the fact that the last surviving animal, which was a zoo animal, was a male, and they managed to recover semen from him during his life. That got frozen. It's now in still in the deep freeze. But the idea is that at some future point, when it makes sense and the technology permits it, to see whether his inheritance can be used to fertilize a southern white rhino, which is not undergoing, or has not yet at least undergone, the same kinds of dramatic population losses. So what you get is a hybrid, and you can say, well, that's not very natural. It is completely natural. Hybridization is a common thing in among vertebrates. And what you would get back, I hope, would be sort of a iconic poster animal that shows that extinction doesn't have to be forever, but why bring yourself to the situation where you have one last chance, right?
Yeah.
Intervene at an earlier point. Stop the madness.
Absolutely. I mean, it is quite catastrophic, regardless of if we'll ever fully know, or regardless of what we can learn from these stories of the past that you so beautifully tell. We know that we're at a critical point today. You know, I often like to think about, you know, part of the reason that I was so transfixed when I got a copy of your book across my desk is that I recently visited the Peruvian Amazon, and I spent some time with both some indigenous guides and some guides from around the world walking around in the Tambopata portion of the rainforest. And I was speaking to a botanist who specializes in what he calls megaflora, which I just love. And they're these vestiges, right? These ecological connections to these ancient creatures. And when we talk about things like avocados and castañas, Brazil nuts, these things were dispersed by the creatures that we now know are extinct, but we can enjoy them in a modern context. And I just think that ghostly reminder, for me at least, is so important to kind of take stock in what happened and remember that we won't have these things forever. And it's up to us to make, I think, decisions now, decisions with our wallets, you know, about things like palm oil, decisions with our interests, using social media, because we can make a difference in this. And we've already started to with, as you mentioned, the conservation efforts that are happening today.
Absolutely. You know, there's the old quote from Santayana, George Santayana, that those who ignore the lessons of history are doomed to repeat them. Mm-hmm. The more that we actually do know about the human past, and not just the human past, but the natural history past that was going on at the same time, one hopes that the lesson that is learned is that although ecosystems can be resilient, the more you pound on them through asset stripping, like we do all over the planet, the less likely they are to remain integral. And once they begin to degrade, then it's a very, very steep slope to bring them back in many cases. And why would we even want to think that we should be able to do that? What is it that sort of gives us the power to go out into the planet and do practically whatever we want with no repercussions? It's, I don't know. The only way of getting that message across, perhaps, is to have people somehow experience what it's like to be in a situation where everything that once lived there does no longer.
Yeah,
you appreciated that from being in Amazonia and having your guides explain to you the weirdness of having these plants that must have been eaten by the large mammals of the time, because there isn't anything in their size range now that could possibly eat them, and therefore didn't get their seeds distributed. Well, you don't have to go far in our country to see where agribusiness has completely altered landscapes, so that all you see is monoculture in every direction. That is not natural. I'm not saying it's not needed. You have to feed people, but does it have to be done in this particular way, given the wealth of this country and our capacity to innovate technologically? Does it always have to be that it's this kind of I don't care attitude and you just do as you please if you own it?
You know, I think that this this opens up for a beautiful transition. I often, and gosh, I could talk to you all day. And one thing I do feel like I need to give a shout out. First of all, you know, we've been talking about the content of your book and, you know, allied conversations, but we didn't take a moment to talk about the beauty of this publication, because of course you wrote it, but it was illustrated by, am I pronouncing his name correctly? Peter Schouten?
Schouten, yes.
Schouten. And it's just stunning, these natural history illustrations that show, really do bring these, you know, beasts, these enormous creatures back to life. And not just that, but there are some kind of maps and more infographical, I just made up a word there, illustrations that are quite helpful for painting that picture. So I did want to give a shout out there. But the segue, because we're running out of time and I'd hate to keep you longer than, you know, how long I've already kept you, is that I close each episode by asking my guests the same two questions. And they're these big picture questions. And we're starting to get into this more big picture conversation. So I was hoping that you would be willing to stick around maybe a couple more minutes and give us your insights on my final two questions. What do you think?
Certainly, I'll do my best.
All right. So when you look to the future in whatever context is relevant to you right now, whether it be in your work, in your personal life, you know, any approach that you take, number one, what is the thing that does really keep you up at night? The thing that you're legitimately concerned about, and maybe even, I don't want to go so far as cynical, but maybe a bit pessimistic about. You don't see how things are going to get better. But on the flip side of that, of course, so we end on a positive note, genuine optimism. Where are you sitting with, not lip service, but real open-mindedness and optimism about the future? And sometimes those are the same thing. Sometimes they're quite different.
Okay. For the first question, for me, it's easy because there is one paramount thing that we as a species have to deal with, which is, why are there so many of us? Mm-hmm. Human population now is about 7.5 billion. I'm 70 years old. So when I was born, it was a third of that size. So in one lifetime, we've had an increment of three times population.
And that increment is a large number as it is. We're not just talking about tripling. We're talking about tripling a massive number.
Yes, we are. And this has nothing to do with politics, racial politics, anything of that nature. It's simply the size of the number. Mm-hmm. If there is no stemming that, then I have only the bleakest outlook for what the future is going to be like. Why is that? Because resources are so unequally distributed across the world, and how resources are used, who has access to resources. So we're setting ourselves up for some kind of hideous denouement. I don't know what it's going to look like. I don't want to speculate. What I do know is that it is just terribly important to realize that the more there is of us, the less opportunity every other thing that's living on the planet has. Mm-hmm. Just as we've invaded every kind of ecosystem on the planet, as we continue to expand in numbers, those places get smaller and smaller, which means that the pressures on the species that live there get higher and higher. It's why we're having a sixth extinction. It's not all about climate change. Yeah. It's about what we have done and what we continue to do.
It's about that biodiversity. And the truth is, even from the most narcissistic perspectives, that puts pressure on ourselves. That's something that we, you know, obviously we are part of we are the problem, but we are also feeling, and as you said, obviously, the weakest, the poorest, the least capable, the least secure among us feel that hit first. And that's the real tragedy here.
It is a fundamental tragedy. And I see now even less effort on the part of, say us in the United States, whereas formerly we used to distribute birth control information and all of that kind of thing. Now we don't. And this is a wrong thing. It's a very wrong thing. We are in the position to help because we are so wealthy. Anyway, that's the sort of thing that keeps me up late at night sometimes.
Absolutely.
So let me go to the other question and now be very much more positive. Because we're humans and because our brains are fundamentally important to why we've been a successful species, in fact, overly successful species over the last million years or so, this is what we've got, and this is the only thing that is going to carry us through. I don't for a minute believe that all technological innovation, no matter what it is, has a positive spin to it. But what I do believe is that as things get perhaps even more difficult than they are now, there's going to be a commensurate increase in finding solutions. And let's talk about one of those. Fossil fuels. I don't need to emphasize, I'm sure, for your listeners, that this is the thing, the fundamental thing that we have to come to grips with. The more fossil fuels we're using up, the more we're pumping greenhouse gases into the atmosphere, with all of the effects that involves. So let's find the alternative. I don't have one, but I will say that it is high time that we stopped being terrified, for example, of using nuclear power. It is what we've got. And the way to ensure that we don't have lots of nasty Fukushima-type problems is to ensure that the engineering gets better. Put the nuclear power plants in places where people aren't, where you can be certain about the geology, where you don't have to worry about weather and other climatic effects having any kind of impact on the actual on the actual power plant itself. And why I am in favor of that? Solely because that's our only likely alternative, and because there's no greenhouse gases except water vapor.
I agree wholeheartedly with that argument. I've long been somebody who supports the use of nuclear and who sees.
Does that mean you don't have any friends, Carol?
Right? No. It's tough. It's tough being both politically liberal but also always on the side of science, right?
Tell
because sometimes they don't mesh together.
Exactly.
Yeah, exactly. But it's so true. We do have viable alternatives today, and you know the political will isn't there, and that is frustrating. But it's also, I think, an exciting prospect to see that there are solutions right in front of us that we can tap into right now.
Precisely.
Ross, this has been a fascinating conversation. Your book is simply beautiful. The prose is so clear. It's masterful. You are a wonderful storyteller, in addition, of course, to all of the incredible science that you do, which we didn't even really get to touch on. So hopefully soon
we can
have you back on the show. We didn't talk about all the great expeditions you've been on, and there's just so much there. But I just want to thank you so much for joining me, because it really was a pleasure.
If I have 30 seconds, I would like to very quickly plug Peter Shooten, who is the illustrator for the book.
Please do.
He's not well known in this country. He's Australian, but in Australia, he's extremely well known. He is a wildlife illustrator. That's his work. But early on, he got interested in extinct species. And he's done a number of books with people like me, with scientists who do take care of the text and that sort of thing. And he illustrates them. And this has been one of the most interesting collaborations I've had in my scientific career, to be able to work with somebody who just has an intuitive sense of what these animals probably look like.
Mm-hmm.
So if you buy the book, you needn't buy it just to hear me. You can have it as a wonderful atlas or a collection of images of the disappeared, megafaunal disappeared.
Absolutely. It really is stunning, you guys. End of the Megafauna, the fate of the world's hugest, fiercest, and strangest animals, with words by Ross McPhee, but illustrations by Peter Shooten. Ross, thank you so much for being here today. It was a pleasure.
Thank you, Kara.
And to everybody listening, thank you for coming back week after week. I'm really looking forward to the next time we all get together to talk nerdy.